This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As always, we appreciate you taking time out of your day to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you're with that esteemed group of people that honor us by joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find a link to the chat room. And if you want to go ahead and join in with the usual suspects, if you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or if there's a question you would like for us to direct to our guest, that's a great place to put it in. We'll be monitoring that during the course of the show, and we'll be glad to grab your good ideas and have them substitute for our own. And if you got to run off and take care of some business, or if you want to check up on those midrats you may have missed, you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or just take the shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes or Stitcher. And with that out of the way, let's go ahead and dive into the show. As we like to say here on a variety of subjects, there really is nothing new, unprecedented, or that unique if you've made the effort to know your history and to read up a little bit. The fundamentals are the same. The personalities have changed. The technologies have advanced, but the fundamentals are resoundingly the same. In the opening months of World War II, there's a story that I've always enjoyed, but you don't read much about, which is really a shame. Mostly we don't read about it because it's not an all that pleasant story. And it's a defeat for the U.S. Navy. And as a result, we like to go on to those things that make us feel good. But many times in defeat is when you really learn the lessons that you don't want to repeat. And the great victories we had in World War II from Battle of Midway on, a lot of those lessons were directly derived from the sailors and the airmen that belonged to the U.S. Asiatic Fleet, and they won these lessons with their lives and their blood and with their ships. And we should honor that because our predecessors sure did when they incorporated those lessons into developing the fleet that eventually defeated Japan. We have a great guest on today to talk about the U.S. Asiatic Fleet in 1941 and what her story might inform us about the challenges of today. Our guest is going to be Hunter Stiers. Hunter is a fellow at the Hattendorf Center for Maritime Historical Research and provides support to the staff at the Naval War College. He is a regular contributor to the National Interest and also the author of 1941 Asiatic Fleet Offers Strategic Lessons. It was published at the Naval Institute's Proceedings back in August of last year, and we link to that over at the show page. And so in the course of the show, if you haven't read it already, please check it out. It's a great article, and we're just going to grab it and run with it for the next hour. Hunter, welcome to Midrats.
Sal, Eagle One, it is such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
Hunter, it's our honor. It's really a great article you put together last year, and as I said in our communications beforehand, I kind of feel guilty I didn't grab you right after it came out last year, but we're better late than never. And for the listeners that may just know of it, and we'll talk about the final stages of it when she became part of the ABDA fleet. But if you could, let's do a little bit of backing up prior to the attacks on Pearl Harbor. Talk for a bit about what the Asiatic Fleet was historically, what her role is, and as World War II came across the horizon, what her composition was.
So, thank you so much. So the Asiatic Fleet is essentially America's four deployed naval force in the Western Pacific between, we can draw the starting line at roughly Matthew Perry opening Japan in the 1850s. And it continues in various iterations through to George Dewey steaming into Manila Bay in 1898 to defeat the Spanish in the first battle of the Spanish-American War. And then it goes from the Asiatic Squadron to a formal fleet organization protecting American interests in the Philippines, on the China coast, and in the Chinese interior, and elsewhere in East Asia, through to March 1st, 1942, when the majority of the fleet is sunk by the Japanese in a series of really tragic events that did not need to happen over, especially the latter period of the Philippines and Dutch East Indies campaign. And we can talk about that. I think we're going to talk about that period of time later on much more extensively in the show.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the framework that the Asiatic Fleet was operating in, and I think that probably as you as other people have done, and probably you did too, the key figure that we need to discuss is Admiral Hart, who was the commander of the Asiatic Fleet in 1941. Kind of talk about who he was and what he was doing to get ready for a war that he at least saw was pending.
Yeah, so Admiral Hart is obviously he's the key figure in all of this. He is the commander-in-chief Asiatic Fleet. He is a four-star admiral. The U.S. Navy only has, I think it was four-star commands. The Asiatic Fleet, despite it having really not very much combat power for much of its history, especially in the 20th century, was upgraded to a four-star command as really for diplomatic purposes. Essentially, all these foreign powers, Japan, Britain, the United States, France, are maintaining fleets inside essentially, if not necessarily anarchic, but severely dysfunctional China. And so in order to maintain standing diplomatically, this relatively small force of, by 1941, it was two, later upgraded to three cruisers, 13 destroyers, and then it was eventually reinforced with submarines. So it's by December 8th, 1941, it had a strength of 29 submarines, the largest concentration of submarines anywhere in the world. All in all, a fairly small command for four stars. And so Admiral Hart is the final commander of the Asiatic Fleet. He comes in 1939, relieving a classmate, a Naval Academy classmate of his named Harry Garnell, who was really the consummate naval diplomat, the perfect guy for this job. He was an Asia. Garnell was an Asia specialist for much of his career. Admiral Hart comes in. I personally really like Hart. Hart and Garnell, but we're talking about Hart for now. Hart is a submariner for much of his career, and then goes on, has a bit of an unusual career track as a flag officer. He's offered command of the Pacific Fleet's battleships, but turns that down in favor of an organization of heavy cruisers, which are relatively new at the time. And he has some other interesting aspects to his career, which we can get to both earlier on, later. He has a stint running the Naval Torpedo Factory, which has a bit of an unfortunate run-in with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which ultimately has potentially some bad complications for his subsequent tenure as Commander-in-Chief of the Asiatic Fleet. But we can get to that later.
One thing that I found and have always found interesting about the Asiatic Fleet, I'd be interested to see your take on it, is when it came to potential wars that the U.S. Navy was planning against. The fact that we would go to war at sea against Japan was at the top of the list. It was something that we war gamed against, we talked about, we thought about, we built for. And yet, when it came to 1941 and World War II, when the war broke out, and the world had been at war for, depending upon where you drew the line, 2 years prior, the most forward deployed Asiatic fleet wasn't really manned that well. I like the phrase, you know, their ships were old enough to vote. And when you look at how she was actually equipped, whereas, as you described with Admiral Hart, they were led with somebody who saw what was coming, but he wasn't equipped and perhaps manned to meet that exact challenge. What were the reasons, do you think, that the most forward deployed naval fleet is relatively under-equipped as it was and with such old ships compared to what they knew the threat could possibly be?
Well, I think it's really a case of out of sight, out of mind. The Asiatic fleet, over the course of the 20th century, really declines over the 40 years between Admiral Dewey winning the Battle of Manila Bay, where he has a powerful force of cruisers. And that gradually, eventually the cruisers start to kind of dwindle down, and it becomes essentially a purely diplomatic force. And this is really unfortunate, because forward deployed forces have a depth of insight and, you know, a finger on the pulse of the region where they operate all the time. In terms of manning, the sailors and marines of the Asiatic fleet are, you know, obviously not universally, but generally excellent. They have longer years in service than most of their counterparts in the rest of the Navy and Marine Corps. They're able, under the circumstances, to fight their ships quite well. And one can imagine that with more modern equipment, they could potentially perform, far better. I think a lot of the difficulties the Asiatic fleet encountered in the Philippines and Dutch East Indies campaign was really as a result of equipment letdown, torpedo failures, shells not working. At one point, one of the three cruisers, the engines stop working, and so they have to send in the destroyers in to make the attack on Balikpapan by themselves, which they do in spectacular fashion, albeit sinking empty transports rather than full ones. But so with more modern equipment, obviously, I think the Asiatic fleet could have performed more effectively. But really, part of it was the thinking that the Philippines are essentially indefensible. By some, this eventually kind of shifts around in a couple of different directions as time goes forward. But certainly the Asiatic fleet's poor state of equipment. I mean, you look at actually one of the pictures I saw you posted on the show page is of the Asiatic fleet's destroyer force lying at anchor off, I believe it's Cavite, in the 1920s. And if you look through those ships, they are, with possibly two exceptions, they are the same ships that are ultimately fighting and dying out in the Dutch East Indies and the Philippines in 1942, some 20 years later.
I'm going to try and tie this into a question about how you analogize between the fleet that Admiral Hart took over and what we're seeing going on with the U.S. 7th Fleet over there now. But when Hart took over, he put the fleet – the Japan had already invaded China. They'd been there since 1931. So, China had already been at war for 8 years, and I'm not sure what the what the gunboats were doing, U.S. gunboats were doing at that time, and if anything, because depending on where the Japanese were. But he was not satisfied that the fleet, even as obsolete as it might have been, was ready to fight a war, was he? Didn't he kind of stir things up?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, Japan invaded Manchuria in 1931. They capture that, really industrially valuable region of China and turn it into a puppet state. And then things kind of simmer for a while, and then things really pick back up again in July 1937. And at that point, Admiral Yarnell is in command. And that period is one that I've been doing a lot of research on this summer. I've been going through Yarnell's papers down at the Library of Congress. And especially for our current moment, that's extremely relevant, and it's just generally fascinating. And this goes for both Japanese behavior and also the dynamics of the American forward deployed force. Essentially, when Hart comes in 39, the fleet has been operating at an extremely high operational tempo for about two years, essentially to that month, if not to the day. The Japanese invade metropolitan China in about July 1937. Hart takes over in early July 1939. And Yarnell sees it as his mission, very similar to what we talk about now, that we will fly, sail, and operate anywhere the international law allows. Well, Yarnell saw his mission as to protect American nationals in China wherever they are. So the operations of the Asiatic Fleet as a neutral party in the Second Sino-Japanese War involved, and it's not just the gunboats, but the destroyers are up and down the rivers a lot. The cruisers are anchored in Shanghai and Chifu and a number of these other harbors. The Asiatic Fleet is under Yarnell, the Asiatic Fleet is very active. And there are stories of when a new Japanese invasion force comes and lands in a different port city, there will be an Asiatic Fleet destroyer going to meet them. At one point, there's this one oral history by this one officer on a destroyer called the USS Bulmer. And he describes they arrive at I'm forgetting exactly which city right now, but I think it was near Shanghai. And they come in to meet a Japanese expeditionary force, and they arrive during the landing. And the captain of the ship goes on to do important work in terms of amphibious expeditions. He's heavily involved in Operation Torch. And he's making connections and gathering information about the state of Japanese amphibious landing techniques, practices, technologies. They have a catamaran dedicated landing craft, which we do not have until much later, really, with the Higgins boat in once we get to about 41, 42. So that's one example of how things are the Asiatic Fleet is really actually potentially quite valuable in terms of and an underexploited resource in terms of intelligence and so forth. Admiral Hart comes in and takes over. He sees pretty soon, he senses that a war's on its way. And so he eventually engages in a bit of what we might call strategic triage. He pulls the fleet off of the China coast, with the exception of the Yangtze River gunboats and other relatively small craft. Occasionally some Navy transports will make trips in. He evacuates Navy dependents, so the wives and the children, which a lot of people are very unhappy about until war actually does break out. And he begins trying to train as much as he can because, these sailors are extremely experienced. They're operating all the time, much as the Seventh Fleet is today. But the problem is they have been operating on such a shoestring with, about the the phrase that is repeated in American newspapers and magazines at the time of Yarnell's relief is, Yarnell and his 36 warships. And that's just, and eventually it's unsustainable. There's no time for training, for exercises. And so Hart really starts it up much more intensively to try and train his fleet for war. And the result is generally a good one, as also not just exercises, but also logistical considerations. And so by December 8, 1941, the Asiatic fleet is actually one of the only Allied formations in really the entire Pacific theater of operations to be essentially unsurprised and to emerge relatively unscathed from the surprise Japanese offensive.
That's what I found so interesting. It's a reminder. It's true. Ultimately they paid a huge price, and part of that is the geography of the area. Most of the times, people think of Westpac, they think about how much effort it takes to actually get out there, California to Hawaii, then to Wake, and from Wake to Guam, and then Guam, then you start tickling on it. But when you look at the area of operations on the China coast, down through the Philippines, and into Indonesia, especially when you take into consideration how few places a warship can actually exit that area bounded by, if you wanted to draw a line, Taiwan around the Philippines and down through the Indonesian archipelago. That part of Westpac has more in common with the Mediterranean than it does with what most people think of the huge expanses of the Pacific Ocean and the Indian Ocean. Talk for a little bit about where in that area Admiral Hart decided to operate, and especially with his submarines, how he decided to employ his fleet once things started to go.
So I think that's a great comparison to the Mediterranean campaign of 1941, where you see land-based aircraft playing a really important role, and especially just in a generally an environment that's generally dominated by littorals. So in terms of the strategic geography and the strategic intentions of the Asiatic fleet, Hart, by December 8, 1941, has 29 submarines at his disposal. It's the largest concentration of submarines anywhere in the world. And the hope is that, previously war plans have essentially said it's unlikely that we'll be able to hold the Philippines. The Navy says we might. The Army is initially much more pessimistic, generally is more pessimistic, and then MacArthur comes in and he's much more gung-ho about trying to hold them, even if he's necessarily – it doesn't necessarily go about that in a very smart way. So Hart's intention is to deploy his submarines generally to the north and west to seek to intercept Japanese invasion convoys that would be heading for the Philippines, sort of a forward defense. This would require that Army land-based aircraft hold down Manila Bay and the airspace over Luzon, essentially be able to resist and keep the Navy's bases open for a sufficient period of time until either the Pacific Fleet comes to the rescue or otherwise. And meanwhile, the surface ships, because of the air threat, are going to deploy south. And there are political military considerations that are quite interesting here, too, where since oil is really the vital strategic raw material that's at work in this theater, it's what the Japanese are after. They're down to a very limited supply of fuel by the time that they choose to initiate hostilities, and that is a driving reason why they do. So Hart and some of his contemporaries and colleagues over in the British and Dutch fleet, they recognize that gaining the cooperation of oil officials, oil companies, British and Dutch, in the Indonesian archipelago is going to be really important. And so Hart deploys his surface ships He deploys his two divisions to Tarakan and Balikpapan, these two major oil ports on the west and east coasts of Borneo, respectively. And he sends them down, one with a destroyer tender, one with a light cruiser, as kind of the flagship of each one, each detachment. And he gives them orders to seek to refuel, but to, quote unquote, have difficulty in obtaining a full load. And so be in a position, should hostilities commence, to come in, land Marines, and seize the oil installations and ensure that they do not fall to an invading enemy, or otherwise do not their destruction is not hampered by potential neutrality or otherwise. They want to be in a position to control these resources. In terms of later on, moving sort of at the start of the campaign, the British, meanwhile, they've got Force Z, they've got the battleship Prince of Wales and the battlecruiser Repulse. They are faced with a similar strategic dilemma as Hart in terms of, do we send the surface ships north to try and interdict enemy convoys that are about to descend on our forward base areas? For the British, it was Malaya heading to Singapore. For the Americans, it's Luzon heading to Manila. And the British decide to make a go of it. And they are somewhat surprised because the Japanese fly in just before the campaign a big flock of heavy medium bombers. And that is what sinks Prince of Wales and Repulse on December 10th, 1941. So that action, by the end of the day on December 10th, the Asiatic fleet essentially comprises the largest Allied naval force facing the Japanese in the Western Pacific, equipped as it is with, being small and with ships that are, as Admiral Hart mentioned, old enough to vote. They're supposed to hold the line. And on the tactical level, things don't necessarily pan out as they were hoping for a number of different reasons, technical and otherwise.
Well, I think that, I'm sitting here reading this article of yours. I'm going, well, at some point, Hunter had one of those aha moments, and you began to see a pattern being repeated. And, I think you talked about the lack of ability of due to the budgetary constraints of the 1930s, lack of the ability of the fleet to fire torpedoes. And we might have known our torpedoes didn't work had we had more of a chance to practice with them. What was that aha moment? When did you suddenly say, well, there's some of what's going on today is very foreshadowed by what went on in 1939, 1941?
Well, my perception is that we're currently stressing our fleet in a way that, essentially with increased deployment times, reducing the amount of time for training that's available, increased budgetary pressures, there's not necessarily the resources to expend ammunition, or rather the main battery ammunition of missiles and torpedoes that potentially should be the case. So I think the aha moment, especially, or at least a pivotal moment, I think I mentioned this in the piece, was the missile explosion on launch from USS the Sullivan, where an SM-2 gets launched and explodes right above the ship. I mean, if it had been any lower, potentially in the magazine, it could have potentially been a catastrophic failure. But this it seemed to suggest that there are things lurking in our magazines that at least, I certainly hope they're not there, these potential failures that are waiting to happen. In the case of the Asiatic fleet, these were pretty egregious, and they played a very significant role both in the loss of the Philippines and eventually, arguably, the loss of the fleet in many ways comes as a result of operational decisions made after Admiral Hart is removed from command for political reasons and replaced by a rather incompetent Dutch admiral who essentially throws ships and lives away in something that at least I personally find rather unconscionable. But in terms of the Asiatic fleet's equipment failures, there's a couple of major areas. The first is in submarine torpedoes. And this is an issue that, it's been written about, but essentially they send out these submarines on defensive intercept patrols, trying to go out and hunt down and find and destroy or at least disperse Japanese invasion convoys that are heading for Luzon. This is really the only way that that the United States can potentially hold the Philippines for any protracted period. They run into a couple of issues. The first is that, it's been posited that skippers were potentially a little bit timid because pre-war doctrine is much more for submarines about supporting and scouting for the fleet than necessarily going in and, making daring attacks. The second is that, this is just all new and it takes a little bit of time to warm up when we're doing this, for real for the first time. Then there's the matter of but really, the thing is, in terms of these doctrinal issues, so forth, the Americans take a lot of criticism, and all of a sudden their submarines are going out and they're not hitting anything. And people are thinking maybe they're just not attacking, they're not being courageous enough. It has political impacts in terms of the British and the Dutch kind of get – the Dutch especially get kind of cocky when two of their submarines bring in like four ships each and the Americans haven't brought in any yet. And eventually an American submarine comes in with the same number. And all of a sudden that kind of tamps down that potential political tension there. But the submarines, they actually make something like 40. It wasn't for lack of trying. They make apparently something along the lines of 43 separate attacks on invasion convoys heading for Luzon, and they don't get a single hit. And there's this one oral history by James Fife, who after the war becomes an admiral, very important in terms of nuclear power and so forth. And he's the chief of staff of the submarines of the Asiatic fleet. And they go down day one, they go down to the pier and they're giving out orders to all the different submarines. Okay. And by the end of the day, they've got everybody who's been in port and not already out on kind of a, getting ready, war warning patrol. Everybody's out by the end of the day. And he describes how eventually they come south after the bases at Manila and Cavite get essentially flattened. And the submarines start coming into Surabaya and Batavia. And he describes how as we started to debrief the skippers, we started to realize that there was something wrong with the torpedoes and we didn't know what it was. And eventually somebody comes in who knew how to turn off this one particular problematic detonator, this magnetic detonator that due to actually another political consideration from World War I, where we were very much against commerce warfare, we had this particular type of detonator that would essentially act like a Mark 48, go under the keel of a ship and break its back. The problem was they would explode halfway to the target or they'd hit the target and nothing would happen. Well, this fellow also discovered that you turn it off and they're still getting what should be hit, but they're running deep. And so they're actually running deeper than their set depth. They're not hitting anything at all. And of course, this is extremely hazardous for the submarines because, all of a sudden an explosion halfway to the target or a torpedo track and nothing happens. This alerts anti-submarine forces that are defending the targets they're going after. And, they're now at great risk after, waiting for, and working for hours to get into firing position. And all of a sudden, it all comes to naught. So the submarines are very disappointing for that reason. I can get into also, if you'd like, the matter of anti-aircraft ammunition in some of the cruisers, which particularly the USS Houston. one of the largest aircraft armaments of any of the surface ships in the fleet, 70 to 80% of the shells are 10 years old and consistently fail to explode. And they discover that in a major Japanese air raid that cripples one of the Asiatic fleet's only two cruisers. So these are the kind. So in terms of this equipment failure, in terms of an aha moment, it's just these are the kinds of things that it would be great to know beforehand, know and fix beforehand, before we're sending people into harm's way. You don't want to be sending these guys out with, whether it's in an Arleigh Burke class destroyer or a Northampton class cruiser, so today or yesteryear, when they're not in a position where they can defend themselves or inflict damage on the enemy.
Yeah, we've talked about that topic a few times here on Midrats, and that's one thing that let's get behind the cipher door and talk about our magazines and Weapon X and Y, because there's a lot of work that needs to be done there that hasn't been solved. But for a different venue and a different net to that regard, I wanted to pull a thread on something you mentioned earlier that I think is an important target, especially people talk about politics and flag officers, general officers, and that interconnection as if it's new, and it's not. And you mentioned two things. One, Admiral Hart's history with FDR, how that politics may have played into it, and also the politics that led to the Dutch Admiral getting the ABDA fleet. Talk a little bit about that and the results of it.
Sure thing. So Admiral Hart was actually, he was in command, he was, around the time, a bit after World War, during after World War One, he's in command of actually the torpedo factory here in Newport, Rhode Island. And there's a particular moment where essentially some of the craftsmen, the workers of the torpedo factory, they want to go on strike for higher wages. And as Hart tells it, he says, well, I'm all for paying people a living wage. But he then he essentially said, these craftsmen, and I said to them that they're already making more than comparable, jobs of comparable skill, expertise, comparable work in the region. So he says, I would like to support you, but I really, I can't in good conscience. And FDR is the Assistant Secretary of the Navy at the time, and he comes down on the side of the striking workers. And that seems to have caused a bit of a rift between the two. And FDR doesn't seem to have ever really gotten over it. Hart was very much, when he was coming up for, in about 1938, 1939, he's up for a four-star command. And it's looking like, he might potentially get the big fleet, the Pacific Fleet that's based in California and later is forward deployed to Pearl Harbor. And he gets passed over and instead is given the Asiatic Fleet, which he describes as being a little bit of a disappointment for him. It goes from commanding, the main battle force of the United States Navy to essentially this out of sight, out of mind, what it seems to people in Washington as kind of a backwater. In fact, it probably doesn't seem to people in Washington because they're not thinking about it at all. Actually, speaking of that, the captain of that destroyer, the Bulmer, who was looking at Japanese landing characteristics, he goes back to war plans in 1940 in Washington, and he describes how things that we had slaved over in the Asiatic fleet were just completely forgotten in Washington. There was no running estimate of the situation in force. So all of these issues, there's this real disconnect. And the Asiatic fleet has a bit of its own culture and so forth. So getting back to this this other issue with of how kind of the story of Hart and FDR kind of comes to an end is essentially Hart is now, so it's February 1942. So the Asiatic Fleet has retired in good order from the Philippines south to the Dutch East Indies. And this is after the essentially Douglas MacArthur allows his potent or potentially potent land-based air contingent to be caught on the ground on the first day of the war with about, you know, 8 to 10 hours of warning. And, you know, after 8 to 10 hours after news of Pearl Harbor has reached him, there's, you know, we're not sure what happened, what was his mental state at the time. We think, you know, he was somehow catatonic or something like that. Either way, whatever it was, he did not give an order to his bomber commanders to go and launch offensive strikes against Formosa. So Far East Air Force is destroyed on the ground. Hart decides, okay, in that case, I was hoping we could potentially fight from Manila Bay if possible. That's clearly not going to happen. You know, the bases are being destroyed. Since he's been getting ready and has anticipated the loss of the fleet, he has gotten really the unsung heroes of the Asiatic Fleet story. He's gotten the tenders ready to go. He's got the tenders which really allow the fleet to withdraw south in good order. So then he arrives in Java, and they start setting up this allied command, ABDICOM, American, British, Dutch, and Australian. And there's several points where essentially the you can potentially see FDR's you know, rocky relationship with Hart potentially playing out, where essentially, you know, in highest level discussion, Churchill actually proposes that the new Allied command be led by the senior American admiral in the region. That's Hart, because while, you know, he certainly hates to see British warships under the command of a foreign commander, he says, you know, you have the preponderance of warships now that Fort C has been sunk, and this is primarily naval theater. And FDR says, no, he kind of insists. He's like, no, why don't we put your army commander in charge? And eventually Churchill relents and acquiesces. And so they put this guy, Archibald Wavell, in charge of ABDICOM. Hart is made commander of ABDIFLOAT, which is the naval component. And a British officer is made his deputy, and then the Dutch, who are there, you know, obviously it's their home waters. This fellow Conrad Helfrich is the name of the admiral in question. He's kind of upset that he's not more involved. Hart tries to keep him abreast of all things, you know, is trying to, but Helfrich is generally very, he's making noises. He has a much better relation, much closer relationship to the British than the Americans do. It's really, in terms of the alliance politics, it's really, the British and Dutch have had a working relationship for far longer than the Americans. There have been a couple of planning conferences where, you know, all four nations got together before the war, but really this was it was a really unfortunate case where, even though maybe business cards had technically been exchanged before bullets start flying, it wasn't enough. You have things in terms of making sure that training and signals and tactics are compatible, and essentially none of these measures have really been taken, and so Helfrich, he wants to be very aggressive. He's from the Dutch East Indies. The Americans are trying to be very aggressive at sea, but they're also trying to be strategic and not, fritter away all of their ships in an environment, as you said, it's very similar to the Mediterranean, where Japanese aircraft who have air superiority can show up overhead and start attacking the fleet. The striking force tries to attack on numerous occasions, but eventually Helfrich continues making noises to Wavell, and Wavell starts making noises to Hart, and aspects, you know, generally it focuses on Hart's age, which he kind of jokes about a lot, even though he's still extremely capable, and he's been kept on a little bit longer than the standard retirement, because, you know, he's in theater, it's, you know, not, they figured it wasn't a good idea to change horses. You know, this is going back to about 1940-41. But now, returning to this situation with Abdikov, eventually Hart says, okay, if you're going to keep, you know, coming after this, you know, needling about age, you should come out and say you want me to step down. And Wavell, he thinks that Wavell is kind of embarrassed by this and that the matter's over. But instead, Wavell takes that, sends it to Churchill. Churchill is normally very defensive of admirals. He was very defensive, he was advising the Americans not to second-guess Admiral Pye in the question of the Wake Island relief expedition, which was aborted. But he doesn't add any comment. He just forwards this on to Roosevelt. And Roosevelt instinctively, he's just like, okay, in that case, we'll get him out and why don't we put the Dutch guy in charge? And little does he know, the Dutch officer, Helfrich, has no experience in commanding task forces. He's not thinking about the logistics of making sure that the forces are compatible, they can work together. He just thinks, okay, he sees ships, we will put them all in the striking force and send them out. And eventually Hart, you know, King says, okay, what's going on? Ernest J. King asks. Hart explains, King does not want to relieve Hart, but eventually is essentially overruled. And Hart is detached nominally for medical reasons. And so that's actually the reason that his narrative of events of what happened is actually classified until 1972. So that's certainly it's a very interesting, it's a very sad period of time, because the result is that Hart, who was essentially, you know, not necessarily more cautious, but, you know, much more strategic, is replaced by this guy, Helfrich, who doesn't really know what he's doing. He doesn't realize that the defense of Java is not necessarily, in the grander scheme of things, you know, something that you should, you know, defend to the last ditch, rather than, you know, withdrawing your naval forces in good order to Australia. And so he essentially sends the striking force into a battle that should never happen, the Battle of the Java Sea, where the majority of it is destroyed, and then the rest of it is completely destroyed over, the vast majority is completely destroyed over that action and then subsequent action, which is, it's tragic. It's genuinely tragic.
Yeah, as I was reading through your piece, I was just picking out the lessons that we, I think we now would look at, and maybe we've got some of them addressed, but, I mean, there's the danger of having what I would call a show-the-flag fleet, you know, and not a sufficient fighting force to meet your most likely opponent, although the theory, I gather, was that the Pacific Fleet would come sailing in from Pearl Harbor and rescue the Asiatic Fleet if necessary. There's the problem of the tyranny of distance. You know, for U.S. forces today, even though we don't have the same kind of base structure they had in the Philippines in those days, but, you know, you're always playing an away game. There is no, and as I think you point out in your article, almost all the bases that we would use to support our fleet now are within striking range of the most lethal, probable opponent in the region. We've got dangers of coalition warfare that we address somewhat through the RIMPAC exercises, where we actually get together with our allies and try to figure out those issues of common language and tactics and stuff. You've got issues of joint warfare. I mean, Hart did not get along with MacArthur at all, as far as I can tell. And then to have MacArthur, I think he believed that the Japanese wouldn't invade before April. And as a result, that's why he got kind of caught flat-footed when they actually came sooner. But, you know, when you're relying on the Army Air Corps to have all those B-17s and B-24s and fighter planes to fend off the Japanese air attacks, and they're all destroyed on the ground, that kind of, as you've already said, that really throws a monkey wrench into your planning. The we're constantly engaged now in this discussion of the quality of our ships versus quantity. You know, is it, I think that an example of having a quantity of ships, but none of which were really all that good, seems to be an issue that DeHart was facing. And then the lesson that I really like at the end of your article is on logistics. As a guy who used to be in the service force where we were riding ammo ships and all that, I cannot believe that we don't have much more of a logistics force, because as you know, those bases that we think we're going to be able to do our vertical load VLS cell stuff probably may not be there. I mean, that's I know they're working on a fix for that, but anyway, I was really impressed when, as I went down there, I think I've got like 9 items. I said, this is stuff that still exists. Did I hit all of them, or do you think there are more lessons we should be getting out of this that confront us as far as strategic lessons go?
Well, I think I'm in violent agreement with you there, that the logistics is, I mean, that's what I really enjoy focusing on. Is I think that is very much the story that kind of the number one takeaway there, where essentially, I mean, the reason where Hart's preparation, besides training, where it really comes in, where the rubber really hits the road, is in logistics. Hart is actually anticipating a Japanese attack somewhere potentially in the fall of 1941. So he has his fleet working overtime to be ready to go when that happens. And after that happens, he thinks, okay, maybe the danger's actually passed. They're not going to go to war with us in fall of 1941. So there's a little bit of a stand down. But nevertheless, the key part is that the tenders were more or less loaded and ready to go in anticipation of Manila Bay becoming untenable. And that's a lesson that I think that's something that I absolutely agree. The Combat Logistics Force now is, I think people don't realize that they, especially in the Asiatic Fleet story, the logistics force, they are the heroes. When they allow the Asiatic Fleet to withdraw in really good order down to the Dutch East Indies because they're mobile, and then when the tenders withdraw too far to Darwin, Australia, all of a sudden they're out of position, and that's actually when you start to see things start to go wrong for the Asiatic fleet. That's when the maintenance starts to really take its toll, or rather the lack thereof. That's when they start running out of ammunition. And so really the tenders, that is the crucial component. And what really scares me is that we no longer have – there is not a single destroyer tender left in the United States Navy. We had a group of about – I would say there was 2 classes, one of 4, one of 2, so 6 tenders that we had in the 90s and then retired in the later part of the 1990s. We put them into the ready reserve fleet I think the youngest was maybe 12 or 13 years in service. The oldest was maybe 17, 18, either way, less than 20. And then actually just a few years ago, this decade, we decided we scrapped 5 of them. And then the last one we kept, but it was kind of poetic. We didn't scrap it. We blew it up. We sank it at RIMPAC or one of these other exercises into ThinkEx. And that was something that potentially could be returned to service. And this is all right at a time of rising tensions with China, where we could really use these mobile logistics assets in the theater. You mentioned, by the way, in terms of VLS reloading, I think that for me is the issue, like potentially, that's probably what scares me the most. And I was really encouraged. I had the good fortune of a brief interview with CNO Richardson at the Current Strategy Forum in June here at the Naval War College, and I was asking about forward deployed naval forces and then combat logistics, and And he mentioned, you know, I asked him about what about reloading vertical launch systems underway. And he said, we're bringing that back. So I wrote that up. I essentially took the last of a 3.5-minute interview, took the last 4 words he said, and built a 3,000-word article on just that. So what seems to be the case is, in, because of the physics of bringing over vertical launch, the missiles that will go into the vertical launch system, the likely solution is going to be a system of forward reloading. You find a, you know, just a harbor, or if it happens to be calm weather outside, you go skin to skin, stationary, you do your transfer, and then you go. And with the declining numbers of ships in the combat logistics force, I think that is really where I get kind of worried, and that we might not be able, we might not have the numbers to do that as flexibly as we need. And certainly, you know, the lack of destroyer tenders, which were, you know, they played in a very important role actually in Gulf War 1991 in performing Tomahawk missile reloads in theater. It was the first time we had actually reloaded Tomahawk missiles outside the United States. We were in, I want to say, Jebel Ali, and then there was one point where a ship met a tender in the lee of Masira Island off Oman, and they did a transfer there, not anchored in case they came under fire so they could get underway. But you know, these are the kinds of measures, the kind of flexibility, whether it's, you know, Ulithi Atoll or, you know, something in that vein, Palau. These are, you know, we have essentially in these little out-of-the-way harbors that the Asiatic fleet, by the way, spent a lot of time surveying for Navy planning staff and so forth. These are the kinds of plans that I'd like to see us kind of pull off the shelf, dust them off, send some survey ships around, and then essentially all of a sudden, if you know where the good harbors are, and maybe the Chinese do, maybe they don't, all of a sudden you can potentially hide outside of the major metropolitan centers, you know, for a couple of hours, do your reload, run away, and you know, very much in the vein that General Neller of the Marine Corps and the Chief of Staff of the Army have been talking about, that, you know, everybody has to stay moving on land. I think it's the same thing at sea in order to survive. So I think there's a so that's – I absolutely agree with you. The logistics is the crucial element of this story. And that's certainly – I hope we have the wherewithal to invest heavily there.
Yeah, Hunter, we're in full alignment there. We've talked about it here on the show a few times, the unsexy but important. And the tenders are one of them. And especially when we talk about, you know, with each advancing year, whether under military or political threat, the bases that we have in Japan and Guam and elsewhere, if you want to be able to get out there and fight, you have to have that ability to do exactly what you said and what the tenders can do. And the decisions to decommission and get rid of that tender capability were made for all the wrong reasons. And there's, even in peacetime, there's a secondary impact of it. And as I was getting ready for the show and reading your work, it reminded me of something that was put out just a few days before the USS McCain's incident, and it has to do with when you're on board a ship, you're not very well rested, you have a certain job to do, and what happens when you get more. And there was an article published on the 14th of August by the Navy. You can get over at Navy.mil. John S. McCain maintains condition readiness underway. It was written as a rah-rah good news story. And here's just a little quote from the center, a little bit of an extended quote here. Quote, in the past month, from beginning of June to 1st of July, we have completed over 204 jobs, unquote, said Chief Warrant Officer Joshua Pettet, Maintenance Material Officer Board McCain, additional quote from him, over 40% of the jobs were depot-level jobs, and yet our guys completed them. these jobs are normally done in port, yet we are finding ways to overcome this and be self-efficient, unquote. And that just begs the question, if that already undermanned ship and her crew were completing those 240 jobs that they are not manned to do, what are they not doing? What are their primary responsibilities that they not have time to do? How much unrested are they? And what type of jobs could have been done if there was a submarine tender so the crew of McCain could concentrate on those duties they're best able to do? It's always great to be able, in extremis, to have the ability to do those types of things on board ships. But when 40% of the jobs that you do are depot-level jobs, if that doesn't give somebody a bullet to fight for bringing back destroyer tenders, I don't know what is.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, it's certainly vital to have the capability to maintain underway, but especially in terms of when these ships are already undermanned. I mean, it's certainly exciting that they were working on that, but at the same time, I mean, certainly in terms of the Asiatic fleet, it's kind of a similar story. They got really good at sort of similar to the Sailors Manning the Oliver Hazard Perry class frigates recently. Maintaining these ships in very with very limited basing facilities and so forth, doing it themselves, and that creates a certain gritty resilience that we should absolutely be cultivating. But at the same time, I agree. We've got to bring these destroyer tenders. They play a vital role, if unsung, in terms of their machine shops and their their ammunition storage, their ability to help people reload in waters forward, near your objective. Considering how quickly you can run through a VLS magazine in a saturation tech, it's an essential capability.
And on that, Hunter, I want to thank you for coming on the show today, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again, judging by the quantity of information you have absorbed, and the way you're thinking about it. Let me ask you: are you working on something now that the listeners can look forward to seeing in the near future? And when will they be able to see it?
Well, current thing that I'm looking forward to right now is getting back to Columbia day after Labor Day, but I plan to continue contributing to the national interest. And I'll see. I look forward to seeing where these areas of inquiry take me in terms of future writing.
Well, Hunter, I absolutely enjoyed having you this afternoon. And thanks again for coming on. I look forward to the next opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm incredibly grateful. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Hope everybody has a great Labor Day weekend. And until then, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Piccadilly.